The greater the mass, the greater the inertia, the greater the resistance to motion. So the very essence of the material world is its resistance to change. So if you amass riches, you are literally reducing your propensity to change. Okay? If you amass material things, you are literally decreasing your capacity to change. So the nature of the material world, the nature of material objects, is their resistance to change. Change, then, in the material world comes from the action of the spiritual world on the material world. Now, how this action takes place, that goes into much more detailed things about science. As I say again, I'll reserve that for my hors série conference tomorrow night, okay, which is not part of the course, it's optional. But there I will talk more about this mechanism, about how the action of the spiritual world affects change in the material world. But for the moment, we'll just take this on the face value of Abdu'l-Bahá's various statements of this fact. So he says that on page 192, quoted in text up on the top of the page, the world of mortality is a world of contradictions, of opposites. Motion being compulsory, everything must either go forward or retreat. So this going forward and retreating is this back and forth motion that is characteristic of the material world. So in effect, in other words, matter is as a resistance, spirit is as a dynamic force which operates on the resistance of matter, and this then generates movement. This generates movement. This, in fact, is Newton's first law of motion, that a body will remain in its existing state of motion until it is acted upon by some force. So, in other words, this is almost a direct quote from Abdu'l-Bahá. In other words, Newton is saying, nothing material, no material object will do anything on its own accord. Unless some force acts upon it and makes it do something, it will just stay in its existing state. This is the law of inertia. Now, this whole system of material entities is bound together in a reality. In other words, the structure is a modular structure. I mean, we have elementary particles, which are little packets of matter, of energy, and these elementary particles combine to make protons and neutrons and so on, which combine to make atoms, which combine to make molecules, which combine to make macro objects, which combine to make systems, and the systems combine to make the material universe. So this is a modular system. A modular system. In other words, it is useless to look at the material universe as just an aggregate of elementary particles. Just the same example of the body a minute ago. It's totally useless to look at your body as an aggregate of cells. And this is why this is the famous principle of indeterminism, such as Heisenberg indeterminism. Whenever you jump a level of organization, then you have a new unit. In other words, the basic unit of life is the cell. It is virtually useless to study an organism on the atomic level. In other words, you can study an organism on the atomic level, such as molecular biology, but you do that in order to know what the properties of the cell are. But when you want to understand the organism, you don't go down to the subcellular level. You take the properties of the cell, you take the cell as the basic unit, and you study the organism as a function of the cell. So it's the same thing in the physical world in general. it's rather useless to think of the physical universe as all these trees and grass and everything we see. It's just a big aggregate of elementary particles. You study these modular systems on different levels. So this whole system that is the material universe is bound together, as Abdu'l-Bahá says in the first quote I read, in a universal system of law. So let's continue that first quote that I stopped. This nature is subjected to an absolute organization to determine laws, a complete order and finished design from which it will never depart. To such a degree, indeed, that if you look carefully and with keen sight from the smallest invisible atom up to such large bodies of the world of existence as the globe of the sun and the great stars and luminous spheres, whether you regard their arrangement, their composition, their form, or their movement, you will find that all are in the highest degree of organization and are under one law from which they will never depart. So this system of reality is bound together by this universal law, which is the law of cause and effect.
The law of causality. So, the one universal law is the law of causality. This is, if you will, the logical law that is universal.
The law of causality. Every law, particularly law like the law of gravity, is a particular instance of the law of causality. Now, the law of causality has certain features which are independent of particular laws. In other words, there are certain, like the law of gravity obeys a certain principles, such as the inverse square principle. The two bodies are attracted to each other by a force that is proportional to the inverse of the square of the distance between their centers. It's Newton's law of gravity. So those are particular features of that law, but there are general features of the law of causality. The law of causality, then, is a binary relation which links two systems in such a way that we say that the system A is the cause of the system B. Now, what this means in practical terms is simply the following, that whenever A occurs, B will necessarily occur. Okay? We say that A is the sufficient reason for B, or that A produces B. This is the law of causality. So the law of causality is such that if I let go of this pin, it will fall to the ground. So as long as this pin, as this object is supported, like when it's laying on the table, it will not move. But if it is not supported, then it will fall down. So this is an expression of the law of causality. Under certain conditions, when certain conditions A are produced, certain results B will always follow from these conditions A. That's the law of causality. It's the basic law of rationality. In other words, human deduction, logic, is simply the abstract expression of the law of causality. When we say that a proposition P implies a proposition Q, this is simply a reflection of the law of causality, mirrored in the human intellect. But then we can say more about that. So this capacity for understanding is the basic capacity of the human being. The capacity of human subjectivity to mirror or model the intrinsic law of causality is the essential property of the human soul. Baha'u'llah says, this is in the Gleanings, that the greatest gift that God has given to man is the gift of understanding or intellect. And he goes on to mention the other gifts, the heart and the will and so on. But he says the greatest gift is the gift of intellect. And he says the reason that we have the gift of intellect is so that we can know God. But this same gift of understanding also enables us to know that which is right and wrong and to discover the secrets of creation. So, now as we will see ultimately, to know God and to understand the law of causality is the same thing. There is no difference, really. In other words, the law of causality, the properties of the law of causality are in everything, is an expression of the nature of God. So ultimately, to understand the law of causality or to understand God or know God is really the same thing. So I just mentioned that in the beginning, but if you don't see why that's the case, don't worry about it, because one can only see that after one has made certain deductions. But you can take my word for it that it works out that way. Okay? We'll see. Okay. So Abdu'l-Bahá says very clearly that the greatest gift that God has given man is the capacity to understand this law of causality that is embedded in the very structure of existence. So if we look on page 193, he says, the outcome of this human intellectual endowment is science, which is especially characteristic of man. This scientific power investigates and apprehends created objects and the laws surrounding them. It is the discoverer of the hidden and mysterious secrets of the material universe and is peculiar to man alone. The most noble and praiseworthy accomplishment of man, therefore, is scientific knowledge and attainment. And then he says, all blessings are divine in origin, but none can be compared with this power of intellectual investigation and research, which is an eternal gift producing fruits of unending delight. Man is ever partaking of these fruits. All other blessings are temporary, thus material. This is an everlasting possession. It is an eternal blessing, a divine bestowal, the supreme gift of God to man. Science, or the attribute of scientific penetration, is supernatural. Okay. So, the human ability to understand the law of causality, to apprehend the law of causality, is the greatest gift that God has given to man. Now, what does this give us? What does this knowledge give us? It gives us two things. It gives us autonomy, and it gives us the power to increase our happiness or our well-being. It gives us autonomy and well-being. So the result of knowledge of the law of causality, produces two things, autonomy and well-being. Well, let's illustrate this. Let's illustrate what Yes. Add what? Well, I don't want to add those right now. So let's give some examples. Without knowledge of the material world, the human being still lives in the material world in this stage of his existence and is therefore subject to these laws of causality. In other words, we can never break these laws of causality. I can never contravene the law of gravity. I mean, if I'm standing on the edge of a cliff, then I can have the free will to step over the cliff or to draw back from the cliff. In either way, the law of gravity is going to operate. My only choice is to put myself in a favorable condition or an unfavorable condition with respect to the law of gravity. But the law of gravity operates independently of my will. So we are subject to the laws of reality, of the material world in particular. But insofar as we understand these laws, then we can begin to produce configurations by, if you will, the manipulation of these laws, configurations which are conformable to our desires and goals. So let me give a very simple example. Primitive societies, as sociologists never tire of telling us, were hunting and gathering societies, right? So in other words, man lived in a natural condition in which nature simply provided him with food. I mean, there it was. It was on the trees, it was on the bushes, it was running around the forest, and all he had to do was go get it. And so this produced tribal societies, nomadic societies, because societies were mobile insofar as the ecosystem in which they lived provided the food and so on. Otherwise, they couldn't go to a desert if they lived in a forest. But they were not tied to any one local place. And so the social structures of these tribal societies were built around these activities. The fact you have a very sharp division of labor between the man and the woman. The man goes out and gathers and hunts, which takes a certain aggressiveness, a certain kind of ability. And the woman has the children, bears the children, nurtures the children. So she more or less stays home, if you will, raises the children, prepares the food that the husband brings home, and so on. Now, at some point in this process, the human being acquired the knowledge of agriculture. Now, why is agriculture more sophisticated than hunting and gathering? Because agriculture involves a fairly sophisticated knowledge of laws. In particular, I have to know what to plant in the spring so that 5 or 6 months later, I will have a certain product in the fall. In other words, the ultimate consequences of my planting the seed are not immediately obvious. You see, if I'm going to hunt or gather, I need very little knowledge of the laws. I mean, all I need is a very superficial knowledge of where to look for certain things, right? So, in other words, if I'm hungry for apples, then I go to the apple tree and I pick an apple off the tree. And if I'm particularly hungry for rabbits, then I go shoot a rabbit and whatever. So the consequences of my actions are more or less immediate. I want the apple, I pick the apple, and I have an apple. I want the rabbit, I shoot the rabbit with a bow and arrow or a slingshot or something, and I have the rabbit, and I go home and I cook the rabbit. So there's very little delay between my action and the consequences or results of my action. But with agriculture, it's different. Now I have to know quite a bit about more longer-term processes in the world, you see? I have to know that I have to prepare the soil in a certain way. I have to do certain things to it. I have to plant certain seeds. I have to plant them in a certain way. In other words, so if I want wheat instead of apples, then I have to plant wheat. I can't get wheat if I plant apples, and I can't get corn if I plant potatoes. So I have to know what to plant, when to plant it, under what conditions to plant it, how to cultivate it, how to provide for it, and so on and so on. And I have to know enough to know that if I do this, then 6 months later, I will have a certain result. And the acquisition of agriculture is considered, you can look at any textbook on anthropology, as one of the major turning points in the social history of the human race, because this was the beginning of localized communities, because you can no longer be a nomadic community if you are tending your fields, because your fields, you can't move them around, okay? So agriculture was the first basis of fixed communities. And fixed communities means that you have a more stable environment, social environment, Therefore, you have more refined laws and so on and so on and so on. So, you can see then that this is an example of how the knowledge of the law of cause and effect, in this case in the realm of ecology, of agriculture, enables us to increase our autonomy and our well-being. In other words, it increases our autonomy because I now no longer have to maybe go out and hunt every day. You know, I'm not living from moment to moment. I can plant my fields, I can work and plant my field, and then I can go play games and tell stories and make music, you know, and let the earth do the rest, you know. I mean, I have to do some things, but, you know, basically, I am free. I am no longer have to endure the processes of the physical world. I can, in some sense, master these processes. Well, if we want to put it in more scientific terms, we can say that a law of cause and effect, suppose I want to produce a certain effect. Well, there may be any number of conditions which can produce that effect. I mean, a given effect can have more than one cause. There are more than one ways to produce a given effect. So, in other words, the more I have knowledge of the law of causality, if B is a desired outcome, in other words, if B makes me happy, if it makes me happy to have food, if it makes me happy to have a good harvest, all right, then the more I know about the different ways that I can produce this outcome, the more autonomy I have. In other words, this is an increase in freedom or autonomy, and it is also an increase in well-being. It's an increase in well-being because I can produce the outcomes that make me happy, okay? That make me happy. So this is the knowledge that science gives us. It is a knowledge of the law of causality in the material world. Knowledge of the law of causality enables me to bring about initial conditions of systems, initial conditions of dynamical systems, which will produce the outcomes which are favorable to me and my goal. And this makes me happy. So, in other words, insofar as I understand the law of cause and effect in, say, the human physiology, human body, this gives me knowledge of medicine. And therefore, if I get a certain disease, if I know how to cure this disease, so the desired outcome in this case is to be cured of the disease, to be free of this disease. So if I have this disease, if I discover that I have this disease, if this is the present reality, well, if I have no knowledge of the laws of medicine, then I'm simply subject to whatever nature is going to do to me. If I have this disease and I don't have the resistance to fight it off, then I'm going to die, okay? I'm going to die. I will simply be subject to the laws of causality. But if I have knowledge of these laws, then I can take a substance, I can take a drug or a medicine, or I can engage in some activity that will change this condition, that will change the condition of my body and therefore lead to the desired outcome, which is to be free of the disease. So this point should be clear. Is there anyone for whom this point is not clear? That the law, the understanding of the law of causality and increases our autonomy and our well-being because it gives us the knowledge by which we can bring about certain initial conditions, causes, which will produce certain desired effects, such as to eat good food, to be free of disease, to have healthy children, and whatever. I mean, okay. Now, you can say that, well, all of this is just science. That's true, it is just science, but science is from God. But What the Baha'i writings tell us then is that spiritual reality, remember a few minutes ago, I won't disappear that again, but I made the distinction between material reality and spiritual reality. The Baha'i writings tell us that spiritual reality is likewise governed by a law of causality that is objective, exactly like in the material world. And because this law of causality is objective, it is potentially discoverable by science. However, because the spiritual world is not accessible to direct observation, it would take an incredibly long time to discover with our unaided intellect these spiritual laws. So God has ordained a second source of valid knowledge of reality, which is religion. In other words, two sources of knowledge of reality have been ordained by God. One is called science and one is called religion. We have just read from Abdu'l-Bahá his statement that science is from God. Science is supernatural. It is from God. Well, religion, of course, even more obviously, is from God. Religion, by religion, I mean, of course, revelation. The manifestations, the sending of the manifestations. Now, let's see this very clearly. On page 199, Abdu'l-Bahá says, it's on the top of the page in text, religion is the essential connection which proceeds from the realities of things. The necessary connection which emanates from the reality of things. Well, that sounds like exactly what he said about the material world. Well, it is exactly what he said about the material world, except that it applies to the spiritual world as well. So religion is to the spiritual world what science is to the material world. I mean, there's no difference. Religion, in other words, is a knowledge of the law of causality in the spiritual world. That's what religion is. Religion is not an ideology. It is not a credo. It is not rituals. It is knowledge of the laws of the world of being. Now, here Abdu'l-Bahá says explicitly on page 199 at the bottom, he says, the supreme manifestations of God are aware of the reality of the mysteries of beings. Now, I'll explain this in a minute. When we talk about the world of being, we're talking about the spiritual world, not the material world. The material world is the world of appearance, and the spiritual world is the world of being. So, the first philosopher to make this distinction completely clear, as far as I know, was Plato, or Socrates, if you want. It's hard to know what Socrates and what's Plato. But in any case, I mean, one could argue that it was made before, but in any case, it was certainly made very explicitly, very consciously in Plato. So he says, the supreme manifestations of God are aware of the reality, that is the structure, if you will, of the mysteries of beings, of the unobservable spiritual world. Therefore, they establish laws which are suitable and adopted to the state of the world of man. The supreme manifestations of God are aware of the mysteries of beings. Therefore, they understand this essential connection, this connection that we've talked about earlier, emanating from the reality of things, and by this knowledge establish the law of God. Now notice that this answers one question which I've heard a lot of debate about in the Baha'i community, is, and elsewhere, is the manifestation like a, sort of like a hollow reed that the revelation simply comes through him He is a vehicle of the revelation, but he himself does not possess this knowledge. In other words, is God like the source and the manifestation is like the sort of a tube, and God puts the revelation in the tube, one end of the tube, and it comes out the other to us. This, in fact, is the conception that the Muslims have of Muhammad. This is exactly the conception that they have, that Muhammad is an ordinary man who was a vehicle of revelation. The revelation is perfect, the Quran is perfect, but the vehicle is a human vehicle. And Muhammad, in his lifetime, obviously made no effort to create any other impression. He presented himself to his followers as an ordinary human being who is just a vehicle for the revelation of God. So that the Arabs focused on the book and not so much on the personality of Muhammad. However, we can see that quite clearly, as Abdu'l-Bahá says here, and it's clear elsewhere in the Baha'i writing, that this is not the Baha'i view of revelation. The manifestation has the knowledge. In other words, he is, as Baha'u'lláh says, identical with God. He has all knowledge. He says, the essence of the belief in the unity of God is to regard, as to see no difference between God and his manifestation. Now, of course, ontologically, there is a difference, and we will talk about that. But from the point of view of knowledge, there is no difference. That is, the manifestation has all knowledge. He is given that all knowledge by God, of course. Well, the manifestation himself is not the source of the knowledge. He himself is like a mirror who reflects God to us, just as we are mirrors that reflect the light that comes from the manifestation. Nevertheless, the manifestation really has this knowledge. He really understands this. It's not that just he is an automat who is simply recording words that come to him. He has active, complete knowledge of these realities, as Abdu'l-Bahá says here. So, we have two sources of valid knowledge of reality, science and religion. Both are God-ordained. This is another point which I will take the last couple of minutes I have to explain. There's a tendency, even in the Baha'i faith, but certainly outside the Baha'i faith, to consider that religion is from God and science is from man. This is false. This is not the Baha'i point of view. Well, look, we just read from Abdu'l-Bahá where he says that science is from God and that the capacity of scientific penetration is supernatural. It's from God. It's an eternal bounty. I mean, we have it. And if you read Promulgation of Universal Peace, he says this 100 times, okay? And there's no doubt he repeats this over and over again. So science is from God. And in fact, the split between science and religion is really arbitrary. In other words, there's no absolute line where science leaves off and religion begins. This is another false conception, which is an attempt to say that only science gives propositional truth and religion gives only normative truth. In other words, religion gives you the truth that tells you to be a good guy. In other words, it gives you normative truths, that is, value statements. It is good to do this, it is bad to do this. It gives moral imperatives, which philosophers call normative statements, but not propositional truth. Whereas science gives propositional truth, but not normative statements. This is the materialistic way of seeing the relationship between science and religion. This is not the Baha'i way. There are many scientific propositional truths contained in the revelation of Baha'u'llah and in all the other revelations as far as that goes. And there are many normative statements that can be derived from scientific knowledge. So there is no absolute line between religion. So in other words, ultimately, if you want to look at it from the God point of view, from the objective point of view, there is just reality that is, There is the truth about reality, and there is the knowledge about the truth of reality. And we have, God has given us a mind, and the purpose of this mind is to enable us to gain knowledge of reality, to understand the truth about reality. And the truth about reality is the law of causality in reality. This law of causality is universal. That's the first thing I read this morning. It is universal. All of reality is in one coordinated system under one law. But there are levels. And in particular, there is the material world and the spiritual world. And the laws of the material world, God has more or less said, you have enough. You can discover these on your own. Okay? So the manifestation takes some of his time to tell us the laws of the material world, but mostly he leaves this to science. But the laws that govern the spiritual world are very difficult to discover on our own, and so these are given to us through revelation. But the nature of the laws is the same. It is always the law of causality. So let me end just with this story, because I have 2 minutes. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to represent the Baha'i Faith at a meeting at the Vatican. This was a meeting on science and theology, and I was the only Baha'i there. And this was all representatives of all the major religions were there, and materialistic scientists as well. This was science and theology. And the whole idea was to try to sort of establish some kind of a dialogue, as we call it, between, you know, professional theologians and professional scientists, you know, science and religion and so on. And so I participated in this. I presented a paper and so on. And so I represented the faith as best I could and so on. And I had some opportunities to teach the faith to people and establish some friendships and some connections. But towards the end of the thing, as I was observing all this, went on for a week, all of a sudden I realized something. It was something that had been, you know, burgeoning within, that the discourse about science was invariably negative. And the discourse about religion was positive. In other words, everybody's idea was sort of, well, you know, science has been so successful, it has sent people to the moon, it has got them back, it has cured diseases and so on. We have to deal with science because people are impressed with science. But, you know, really it's a bother. I mean, it's just too bad that this science came along and destroyed, you know, the foundation of religion and religious belief, and undermined, you know, the kind of faith that people had in the Middle Ages and so on and so on. So there was this. So I took the floor, and this was about the last meeting. I said, I'm a Baha'i, as you all know, and I said, one of the beliefs of the Baha'i faith is that science is from God just as much as religion. And not only is science from God, but science is just as necessary for the spiritual development of the human being as is religion. I said, we all know that science contributes to the material development of the human being, but science is just as necessary for the spiritual development of the human being as religion. We cannot develop spiritually without science. And I said, I wonder if any other religious group has this point of view. Nobody did. The Muslims, the Jews, the Catholics, the Protestants, they were all there. Nobody did. Nobody but the Baha'i faith has this point of view. So we'll say some more about this tomorrow.